Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers, Journeys to the Outer Limits of Theoretical Physics. This is episode 38, The Dimensionality of Space-Time. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/38. These notes include links to the papers that we read for this podcast, and sundry other things. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing all right. I was wondering, what would you like to talk about today?
Well, this was your idea, and I'm delighted that you came up with it, because it comes up a lot in discussions that I have with people online and stuff. The dimensionality of space-time.
By the dimensionality of space-time, you're talking about the number of dimensions in total, or the number of compactified dimensions? What kind of dimensions are we talking about?
Well, this paper, which is called On the Dimensionality of Space-Time, by Max Tegmark from the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, talks about different space-time topologies, basically. Like, what happens if you have more than three dimensions of space, or more than one dimension of time, or less dimensions of space, or less dimensions of time? So he looked at all of these different possible space-times, which could come out of, apparently, superstring theory and some inflationary models. So I guess the idea that he's looking at here, and maybe you can help clarify this, in the inflationary models, it seems pretty clear that he's predicting that different regions of the universe, which is indistinguishable from infinite as far as we know, would have different space-time geometries. And we just happen to be in a region that has 3 plus 1, 3 space and 1 time. And there may be other regions that have different dimensionalities. And he also mentions that superstring theory, because it predicts multiple lower energy limits, indicates that there can be additional solutions beyond the 3 plus 1 dimensions of space-time. So does that also mean different regions in the universe could have different space-time geometries?
Well, I think you'd look at that second one in that anthropic landscape view that we were looking at previously. So that in general, space-time would have one geometry, except during the period while it was switching from one local minima to another.
So you're thinking that this is a temporal thing, that earlier in the universe there could have been different space-time geometries?
I don't think that's what he's saying, and I'm not really sure how that would work in a block universe, what that would mean, that switch from one geometry to another. But I think he's more or less going to say that in general he's just looking at one universe, one thing. Now, that could be different in different parts of a larger universe. So if we have multiple origins, right, if we have multiple places where we get a space-time expansion, then we'll have in different places possibly different space-time geometries with more or fewer dimensions, a non-compactified dimension.
So the compactification geometry of the additional dimensions can lead to different macroscopic space-times. Is that what we're saying here?
I don't think he says too much about that. He says that he thinks that the fact that you can have these different geometries is a strength of string theory, not a demerit, or not a weakness of string theory. He thinks it's a good thing. Most of these arguments that he's giving are somewhat anthropic.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not really sure that the anthropic argument is really that much of an awesome thing for a theory to be based on.
He says they're not quite as anthropic as I thought they were. In general, the things that he's saying are, is it possible for this to happen in a universe that we're in? It's really all anthropic in some way. But I think what he's talking about is, if we can only observe a universe with 3 plus 1 dimensions, then that string theory will produce many, many different universes with different numbers of non-compactified space and time dimensions is a bonus, because you don't have to fine-tune those dimensions in some way. You don't need a serious reason why there should be 3 plus 1 dimensions. So instead you have the anthropic reasons.
I understand where he's coming from. It just doesn't seem like a really compelling argument that it's that much of an asset that the superstring theory predicts so many different possible space-times, you know.
I don't think it's really to string theory's credit. I don't think this makes it any more likely that string theory is a good theory. But I do think it would be nicer to have something that said there must be 3 plus 1 dimensions of space-time that was fully theoretical, that came from the bottom up, came from some basic ideas about how the universe works, instead of looking at what the conclusions you can come to from looking at what kind of universe we need to actually be around. And I think that brings us to sort of the worst of these arguments, which is, life as we know it, life as a person, needs to have at least three dimensions, because the nervous system wouldn't work if there were only two.
Yeah, that was interesting that you couldn't have any connecting neurons if there was two dimensions of space or less.
In the way that neurons work right now, the neurons would overlap and then you couldn't receive unique signals and everything would be screwed up, and so you couldn't really have an observing body.
Ah, okay, that's what he was saying. So you need the third dimension to separate them so they only touch at the dendrites, right?
That's right. That's sort of the claim. There wasn't too much about that. That might make it seem like a worse argument than it really is, but it's still not really satisfying. You know, you can imagine that rather than having the structure that we have, you just have some sort of branching fractal structure, and then everything should be fine with that. I mean, there are other things, just like, say, the digestive system. Our digestive system can only work with a three-dimensional object, right? You can't have a big hole going through something in two dimensions, because then you have two things.
And gravity. You also pointed out you can't have gravity. Without gravity, you can't have, like, element formation, right? Higher elements?
Yeah, I don't know enough about that. He was referring to Wheeler's book on gravitation when he was talking about that. So I hadn't heard that before, that for two spatial dimensions, I guess, plus one time dimension, general relativity or something like that doesn't work. You don't end up with a gravitational force. I mean, that's interesting, but I don't know what that means. I guess if you have two spatial dimensions, you're stuck with a Newtonian gravitation, because that would be perfectly fine.
I wonder. I thought that since Newtonian gravitation was just an approximation of the underlying theory of curved spacetime, and we know that the metric expression is correct, then if there weren't three dimensions in one of space and one of time, I'm thinking that there wouldn't be any gravitational force at all, not even of a Newtonian type.
Well, that's true. It would have to have a different mechanism.
Which is hard to ponder, because, you know, how do you come up with a different mechanism for the same force? You know, it's not the same force then, you know?
Yeah, you might have to add a graviton or something like that. You know, I don't see how you would not be able to have a graviton, whereas I do see how it would be difficult to have a limit in the warping of space-time. There might be a problem with that, right? But why there wouldn't be a graviton, I don't understand. There may be some reason, because the graviton has to be spin 2, and maybe you can't have spin 2 with only two spatial dimensions.
That's an interesting theoretical thing to consider. When you're looking at superstring theory, which has something like, you know, 10 to the 115th solutions or something, it might be possible that there'd be something like gravity using a totally different physical mechanism, because everything is different about the laws of physics in that reality. But in any case, he goes through all these different types of basic examples and shows how dramatically different they are. And he does say that he's not ruling out the possibility of observers in any of these alternative spacetimes. But man, when you look at them, it really makes you wonder.
I mean, when he talks about those things, it should have sufficient predictability, sufficient complexity, and sufficient stability. I think you can be pretty sure that if one of those things isn't there, you don't have observers. And that's what he basically goes through, right, is this is unstable, this is unpredictable, and so forth and so on. I mean, that really says a lot, although it's a little bit weird, right, when he's talking about the two time dimensions. I'd really like to look at some of those references, because when he starts talking about two objects with different flows of time because they have a vector energy instead of a scalar energy, I guess you get one energy component per time dimension. And so you get a flow in time that's different for different objects. And so, you know, things would sort of drift apart in time, whatever that means, when they came near each other. But what happens when these things collide, right? What happens with all these sorts of interactions when they come near each other? Do they somehow sync up with the times? I mean, that would be very interesting to look at. The time flow is a constant of the motion of that individual object, and I suppose all by itself. But I expect that when two objects would collide, that just like energy might be conserved for the system, that still you'd have vector energy conserved for the system, but not for one of the individual objects. So how do those things work out, and what does that mean? I mean, it's just really getting to my brain.
He does seem to be saying that there wouldn't be any kind of bound systems in that case, because there's that extra degree of freedom.
So there was something about energy conservation failing and particles becoming less stable, which is a fairly strange idea. It gets really, really bad later on. You get certain of these combinations where you have no initial conditions that make any sense.
Yeah, well, you can't make any predictions, because no matter how much reasonable information you have about a thing, you can't predict what's going to happen next. So why would any system evolve with problem-solving and cognitive capabilities? That's a good argument. I mean, yeah, evolution wouldn't predispose you to linear thought processes of causality if there was none of that in your universe. So how could you understand physics? I mean, you just had never knew the outcome of any experiment.
Well, exactly. The anthropic principle isn't really the anthropic principle. It's whether or not there are physicists in the universe. A lot of times, actually, these arguments sound very much like that. And I wonder how that relates to your friend Itzhak Barr's two-time physics stuff, how that works. Because it sure sounded like he had that under control, or he thought he had that under control.
Well, yeah, he seems to have found, like, one exception to the structural rule. And maybe we should go over those real quickly, just so people can get the overview of what the arguments are against each of these different space-times. But he seemed to have found an exception to them. So this paper found that with greater than one time dimension, observers couldn't make predictions. And with greater than three space dimensions, there would be no atoms and possibly no stable structures at all, because you can't even get orbits or even quantum mechanical bound electron orbits and none of that stuff. And with less than three dimensions of space, there's no gravity, and it would probably be too simple to yield any observers, he thinks. So Itzhak Barr had a paper, we did an episode on this, 2T physics, where he came up with a model where there are four dimensions of space and two dimensions of time, but they are bound by a specific gauge symmetry, which forces physics to conform to the three space and one time dimension observables that we see. So it's kind of a sneaky trick where you do have higher dimensions, but the physics is bound to give you the results that we're seeing, which is, you know, emulates a four-dimensional space-time. So that's an interesting caveat, but it doesn't really give you the freedom to exploit that extra dimension of space and that extra dimension of time.
You might want to do something interesting with those other dimensions, but from his papers, there's probably something that if his conclusions are true, I guess really if his assumption is true, if that gauge symmetry exists, then there is probably something there you could exploit somehow. Again, maybe not in the Chromtronics sort of way, but there might be something that you could exploit to find out something about the world.
Well, yeah, because theoretically he found all these great insights that way. Like, he found parallels between totally unrelated systems as just like different shadows, basically, of this six-dimensional reality that appear to us as different phenomena entirely. I can't remember them exactly right now, but he found you could explain everything from like an inflationary universe to the Bohr atom to exotic particles, all as different basic shadows of this higher dimensional thing that were all just one object being seen from different directions, which was really cool and fascinating theoretically. I'm kind of curious if his model suggests that there might be some technological way to break that gauge symmetry so that you could exploit those extra dimensions some way, but I don't think he ever talked about that.
It would be interesting to compare some of that with some of this. There were other problems with having multiple time dimensions as well. You know, the sort of things that this guy was talking about with predictability weren't all that was there. There were also things like the ghost particles, which have, you know, certain properties that we don't really like with ghost particles.
I think backward causation was one that he mentioned too, which is like, what? If there's more than one dimension of time, you can have what seems like backward causation.
Well, yeah, this guy was talking about the backward causation is viable. But, you know, we just talked about retrocausality, and that's sort of a backwards causation itself. Although, you know, it depends on which model you're using. So the sort of idea that Aharonov talked about was very much a kind of backwards causation. Something came backwards to, you know, there was a backwards flowing wave that matched up with the forwards flowing wave. Whereas the sort of boundary condition things we talked about in the retrocausality episode, those don't really seem like backwards causation to me.
Yeah, it just seems like the future and the past kind of together define what happens in the present, which is different. Now, I should mention that Ken Wharton wrote on my Facebook page about the last retrocausality episode that we put up, and he said that he's working on a review paper of all the different retrocausal models that I think he said might come out this winter. So we might get to see some of these and compare them, which will be a lot of fun.
Okay, well, I will look for that, and as soon as I see it, I'll get you a copy and we can talk about the different retrocausality models. That would be fun. Let's see. We've looked at predictability, talked about that in the hyperbolic case where you have more than one time dimension, you can't really make any predictions.
Because you'd have to have like infinitely precise data about your initial conditions to be able to make a prediction about the outcome, and that's impossible.
Yeah. Now, in the elliptic condition, where you have no time, no time-like dimension, that was fairly interesting as well. So, because in that case, you have no idea about what happens anywhere in the universe. Nothing that you can look at locally tells you about anything far away. That was a fairly interesting little conclusion. And, of course, there was that very special world that is possible, he says, but we wouldn't show up in it, which was the three time dimensions and one spatial dimension, where everything's tachyons. So he has that little plot, and he has two places that are habitable, ours and the tachyon world. Even though he says, you know, you still wouldn't really be able to do any predictions with it.
Right, because everything would be evolving into the past. That's kind of weird.
Well, I mean, once you start thinking about it. Now, when we get to that one, I guess we're looking at time as a three vector. So everybody's time would be a little bit different.
Holy crap. Okay.
So everybody's time would be evolving in sort of a different direction in time. And so you might pass somebody for a short amount of time, but for the most part, you'd never actually see them. And I don't know what short amount of time would mean. I guess a short space-time interval.
So let me think. You'd see them, but you wouldn't see them coming. Is that something like that?
It's really hard to envision what all that stuff with the time vector means, right?
Yeah, what kind of space-time would that be? I mean, what would general relativity be like with three dimensions of time and one of space? And if you've only got one dimension of space, I guess, boy, all your degrees of freedom are basically in time.
Yeah, so I guess occasionally you'd be in a local neighborhood of someone else in time. And then if you were close enough, maybe you could communicate. And I guess you probably wouldn't have to worry about that because, again, living, thinking things probably wouldn't exist. But if you were a bunch of quarks, if you were like three quarks wandering around and every once in a while you'd come close to two quarks or something like that, you could really talk about things like quarks still.
Yeah, because he's talking about all particles being tachyons with imaginary rest mass.
But does that mean they're all the same kind of tachyon? I don't know enough about tachyons. I try to avoid them.
Yeah, I don't know. He doesn't get into the details on it. It is hard to see how there could be any stable matter or anything in a situation like that.
I'm sure there's no really stable atomy things or anything like that. Actually, I'm not sure about that. With these collisions, there is the possibility that somehow things collide in just such a way that they end up with the same
momentum in time.
Time vector. And I don't know how the collisions would actually work. So you might be able to agglomerate some large amount of matter in some way. It's all traveling in time in the same direction of time. What that would mean, I don't really know.
But how can a collision yield motion in the same direction and still conserve momentum?
I mean, it depends on the angle of the collision, right?
But is there any combination of angles that leads to the same direction as a byproduct? Let me think about that. Yeah, I guess if you came in at an acute angle, yeah, so I guess it could, but it would have to be perfect, right?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to have all sorts of things actually working out, and that's part of the problem. That's why he spends so much time talking about, you know, the partial differential equations, is to try to talk about how stable different combinations are.
Yeah, so he looked at those three different possibilities, the elliptic solutions, the hyperbolic, and the ultra-hyperbolic solutions. And then he also shows them by the space-time signatures, you know, what the different options are there with positive and negative. A topic that sometimes comes up, more so lately it seems, that there's been a lot of talk, I guess partly because of different science fiction stories and so forth, and people love to talk about multidimensional things. And I think that a lot of people have this idea that there could be other realities superimposed on our reality that we can't see, and that somehow multidimensional physics could explain that and reconcile that, so there could be more to reality than we see. So this is an interesting look at what the real physics of macroscopic dimensions are like, and the kind of problems you run into. There doesn't seem to be really any physical way to couch the question of, to couch the hypothesis that there could be other facets, other dimensional facets, that is, in space and time, that would allow these different realities to superimpose on top of one another. Like, if our space-time geometry has to be three space dimensions and one time dimension to show the physics that we see, there can't really be higher extra dimensions of space and time and all this stuff for things to hide in and then encroach on our reality. And people are considering all kinds of ideas that maybe really exotic experiences are coming at us from these higher dimensions and all that stuff. And there's just fundamental physical issues with that, you know? The reason why superstring theory works is because all of those dimensions are folded up into these tiny little hyperdimensional balls that are so small that I guess even an electron can't enter them, you know? So there can't really be other realities in there because you're talking about something that's just smaller than an electron.
Yeah, it's hard to envision what those are, so...
They're closed, right? They're like knots. They're like, there's not like an open end to it for you to go into.
It's just so hard to really envision what those really are. They're closed, they're small, and everything is always evolving in them very, very quickly. They're not going to do anything like spin around every picosecond or something like that, and every 5 degrees, everybody's eye color changes or something weird like that. But you don't notice because you only notice things at 10 degrees, not at 25 degrees, right? So, yeah, I don't see any real physical way for those things to happen. I mean, it's like so many things in science fiction. They make great stories. But they often riff off of the words that are being used to describe something rather than off of a deep understanding of the science behind them.
Right. Like the many worlds interpretation, people hear many worlds and they think, oh, there's, you know, all these different worlds like right on top of ours in some kind of, they're separated by some kind of frequency or something, right? You know, people get this idea that there's all these different things right on top of us, but that's not what the many worlds interpretation says.
Yeah, that's just a weird one. I mean, the big thing about that is really just the universal wave function and trying to interpret the universal wave function. And that's just a weird thing to try to interpret those words.
Yeah, I've never quite understood wherever it thinks all these realities are. Like, how do they coexist? Like, they can't coexist in the same space-time, right?
No, they're just different eigenstates of the universal wave function. So we're in one eigenstate and somebody else is in another eigenstate, but the universal wave function cannot collapse, so all of the eigenstates exist, but they're distinct.
How would they be separated, or are they separated in space-time? Like, are they in a different place? Because, you know, we're here, so where is that other eigenstate, you know?
I don't think there's any answer to that. My interpretation of what I've heard is that they're all superimposed. But whatever it is we're seeing is part of one of those eigenstates, one of those superimposed eigenstates. And there's some probability for each one of them. That's basically it.
But that would mean, but you couldn't cross from one to the other then, right?
No, you're stuck in your own.
So like the entire space-time is like splits off at every quantum event and becomes its own space-time, right? With its copies of the matter and everything else.
That's how I understand people when they're talking about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
They aren't superimposed realities, different branches that are...
Totally causally disconnected, I think, right?
Yeah. Once the branch happens, they never come back together, as far as I understand it. I mean, possibly they do come back together if the two branches are completely identical. Because once they're identical, you know, you have the same probability. It doesn't matter all the different possibilities in an experiment that something could be spin up at the end. That's still that eigenstate for that experiment, right? You just have this infinitely complex eigenstate for the universe. And so with that sort of complexity, the chances that the eigenstates will end up being the same for any two of these universes is probably zero.
Yeah, otherwise it wouldn't branch off in the first place because it would be the same thing.
No, I'm saying that they come back, they branch off, and then at some point for every variable...
Oh, boy.
They're the same. Then maybe they coalesce. There's no way to really interpret that probability anymore, right? You no longer have any kind of statistical interpretation, any kind of ratio interpretation, any kind of even subjective interpretation of those probabilities. There's no way to make an interpretation of a probability of a universal wave function other than it's impossible and it's not impossible. So it's either zero or very, very, very small.
And if it's small, then it happens.
Well, if it's small, it's got a universe like ours, right, where people are sitting here talking about things that superimposed with all the other ones. But what superposition means doesn't make any sense either, because what does superposition of the wave function mean if there's nothing to observe it? I shouldn't say observe, but if the wave function never actually collapses, if the wave function is never forced to be in one state or the other, the rest of quantum mechanics, you know, you have a rule, you observe something, it has to be in one of the eigenstates. Well, there are no external observations of the universal wave function, I assume, because what's outside of the universe, right? There's no point where the universal wave function is forced to be in one state, or it's actually always being forced to be in that one state. So then the interpretation of the universal wave function doesn't make any sense either. So either it doesn't make sense because there's nothing to make an observation, or something inside is making the observation, at which point it's always going to be collapsing. And so the universal wave function still doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. How do you have a superposition of universes?
That's basically the Everett doctrine, that you have a superposition of universes. That's what the multi-world interpretation is.
But we've got observers in this universe, so...
I don't think we count as observers if we're inside the universe.
That's an interesting question. I never thought about that from a quantum mechanical point of view.
Yeah, that was the whole problem that Schrodinger had, right? That's why he has a cat in a box, right? You're outside of the box, and you're trying to figure out whether or not it's alive or dead. At what point does it count that the cat is alive or dead? When you open the box? Does it matter whether or not you're a veterinarian, right? If you're not a veterinarian...
you can't tell if the cat's alive or dead.
What does your opinion mean? You're not trained to figure out about...
You don't qualify as an observer. I always thought it was rotten to not count the cat as an observer. I mean, the cat knows whether it's alive or dead, right?
Yeah, but he could be in one of these two eigenstates, right? So then you say, well, the state's evolving, right? So the eigenstate with the alive cat is in there, and that's sort of the universe we're in. And there's the eigenstate with the dead cat, and that's, you know, one of those universes where we did something really stupid when we were 17, and we're not there anymore. But that's the whole problem with the Schrodinger's cat, is that as far as you're concerned, as far as the math is concerned, as someone outside of the box, you can't make a prediction about the cat being alive or dead. Obviously he is, but was the cat the thing, or was it, you know, when the little bottle of poison broke, right? Or was it when the radioactive atom was ejected from the sample, right? At what point does that wave function collapse? And there is no definitive point where that collapses, except that we know when we make an observation, it has to be in an eigenstate. So the cat has to be alive or dead. The spin has to be up or down. As far as I'm concerned, as far as Schrodinger is concerned, it doesn't matter which one of those it is. The question doesn't change. And it just does not make sense that you opening that box made the cat dead or alive, any more than that cat being in the box shattered that vial of poison or not. That glass has to shatter before the cat can decide that it shattered, or the cat can start sniffing the cyanide and die. And the vial of poison, it obviously doesn't have any sort of brain. So what it thinks about whether or not the radioactive sample ejected that atom is completely irrelevant, because it doesn't think anything. So there's a reason why John Bell started talking about beables rather than observables. And the main reason is it gets us confused with the role of consciousness in quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah, that's a huge problem. People have all kinds of crazy ideas about that. Because some people interpret that as meaning that their consciousness is like a divine power that creates reality.
Yeah, and in the end, the observation means is probably something more like there was an energy transfer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any kind of interaction, right?
Yeah, so it's probably something more like that. There's been an energy transfer that can't do anything more about it. Yeah, and so really, a lot of these things like that, well, how long have we been talking about Everett? And so when you get to the many worlds interpretation, it just doesn't make sense in any way you can actually interpret it. because there's just no reason why you should have a universal wave function in either the case where there's something outside the universe looking at it, because we don't know of anything like that. That doesn't make any sense. Or in the case where there's a wave function collapse inside of it. So you're just stuck with these evolving eigenstates. So you've got these evolving eigenstates sitting around doing their thing, but with no relationship to each other.
Yeah, because the dead cat and the live cat can never interact.
Yeah, they never have a partner.
The live cat can't, like, you know, play with its dead self. But, you know, that's the kind of crazy kind of thinking that comes out when people start thinking about these issues, you know, this superposition and higher dimensions and all that kind of stuff. I liked this paper because it kind of rules out the idea that there could be beings of a higher dimension, like, sort of overseeing our lower dimensional reality. Because if there were larger macroscopic dimensions, either space or time, you run into these really serious issues with organization and predictability.
Yeah, and we've talked about the predictability, but the stability is just as important. I guess Tegmark discussed that a little bit, but he also referred to, and I sent you this, an old article by Bushell, and this was translated, I think, by Ira Freeman in the American Journal of Physics in 1969, that goes through everything as far as what's going on in three space, why space is three-dimensional. And according to this, I probably should have tried to get this other one, the dimensionality of time, that was published the year afterwards in the suggested articles. But I didn't look at the suggested articles until I was just looking at the title just now. Those look pretty good. Anyways, in that case, he's talking about just the stability, and he's talking about what sort of things happen in different cases, right? And I think you've mentioned them. In like 1917, was it? Ehrenfest went through and tried to find this stability of orbits for the two-body problem in higher dimensions. And Tegmark, I think, gives a little graph where he's plotted all these things. It turns out that if you send something around a massive body in four dimensions, either that orbit collapses into it or it veers off to infinity.
Right. There's no stable orbits, which is weird. And he attributes that to an inverse cube force. Right.
Yeah. So if you have higher dimensions, then the potential for gravitation and for electrodynamics changes. The potential in three dimensions is 1/r. So the force is 1/r². In two dimensions, you have a 1/r force. The potential is the logarithm of r, I believe. If you're in one dimension, the force doesn't drop off. And I think your potential is, instead of 1/r, it's just r. So it just increases with distance. The other way down, you start getting into in four dimensions and 1/r³ law, four spatial dimensions. In five spatial dimensions, it would be 1/r⁴, and then 1/r⁵, and so forth and so on.
It's interesting. It's not immediately obvious, just, you know, intuitively, that inverse cube law or an inverse to the fourth power or higher would prevent stable orbits.
You don't think of that right away, but you can sort of think about it. The stable orbit is still a two-dimensional problem, right? So that inverse squared law is balancing the angular momentum and the force, right? And that's all it's doing. It is you're balancing the angular momentum, the energy from the angular momentum with the energy from the force, the potential energy from the long-range force. And that balance just doesn't happen, except in one specific case, which is, you know, space has three dimensions. And again, since we know there are these orbits, our space has to be in three dimensions. Again, it's anthropic. It doesn't make you really, really happy, but at least you have that. Now, it gets a little weird because, you know, in four dimensions, the thing isn't really going around an axis, right? A planet wouldn't spin around an axis. It would spin around a plane.
Wow. Okay, that's weird.
I mean, that's why when you do a cross product in four dimensions, you end up with a six-dimensional vector instead of a four-dimensional vector. That six-dimensional vector is trying to describe that plane that's perpendicular to the plane that the orbit is in. It's kind of a weird concept when you get to higher dimensions. What is it really orbiting, and what does that mean now? But the more I think about it, it just means it's going in a circle. it's going in a circle. It's just you have to have this or ellipse, but apparently ellipses are even harder.
I also read somewhere that if we lived in higher dimensions of space, that the number of legs that it takes to stabilize a stool is the number of dimensions of space that you reside in. So in a higher dimensional, like in a four-dimensional space, a three-legged stool would fall over.
Let's see, is that necessarily true? So I guess it depends on whether floors are two-dimensional or three-dimensional.
Well, yeah. Okay. But our floors are two-dimensional.
Yeah, our floors are two-dimensional. In three-dimensional space, it would be 1-3-3-1. Four-dimensional space would be 1-4-6-4-1. So if floors are two-dimensional, or if floors are three-dimensional, probably it requires four legs to stabilize it. And if floors are two-dimensional in four dimensions, then it probably requires six legs.
Okay.
And then it would be 20 in six dimensions. No.
What are you looking at to arrive at these numbers?
I'm just making a guess on why it would be that and using a formula.
Oh, okay.
Thing, and I don't know what they call it. So since I don't remember what they call it, I can't tell you what I'm using.
Fair enough. But it's safe to say that we don't live in a higher dimensional space-time.
I'm pretty sure we don't.
Unless it's constrained by that Isaac Barr's gauge symmetry to create the illusion of four-dimensional space-time.
I guess it's possible that we've got this four-dimensional space-time that's a shadow of that six-dimensional space-time, and that the shadow looks like an orbit, but it's really sort of a more of a corkscrew. That would explain why we never hit ourselves.
You mean when we're orbiting?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just noticed at the end of this, on the dimensionality of space-time, he thanks Frank Wilczek and John Wheeler for discussions which motivated the above-mentioned topics. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the references that he gives that I wanted to look up is his own 1996 preprint.
Look at that. See what else he's got in there.
I mean, most of these are pretty old. So this paper was like 1997, but most of the things that he's referring to were at least 20 years old by then. Many of the other ones, even if they're still available, are very expensive books.
Well, one of the fun, crazy things that he mentions in this paper that I thought was fascinating, and I hadn't heard this before, is that if you've got more than one dimension of time, then a proton can decay into a neutron, a positron, and a neutrino. And an electron can decay into a neutron, an antiproton, and a neutrino. And a photon of sufficiently high energy can decay into any particle and its antiparticle.
Yeah, that reference 10 I wanted to look up to, whatever reference 10 was, the 1969 Dorling paper.
Yeah, that one goes way back, 69.
Oh, no, let me check. That may be one of the ones that was 38. That is that dimensionality of time that was the first one that was recommended on the Freeman paper.
That makes sense.
If I was looking, we could have had another reference that hopefully is just as short as these ones were. And that might have told us something more. That is pretty interesting. You get up into the higher dimensions of time, and the decays change radically.
Yeah, that totally caught me off guard. Don't even know how to make sense of an electron decaying into like super, like much heavier particles, you know. But that has something to do with the crazy vector energy, right?
Yeah, apparently that has something to do with how that conservation of energy works with multiple time dimensions, or possibly doesn't work in multiple time dimensions. So that is a little strange, and I don't know why it would work. I guess if it has to be a photon of sufficiently high energy, there is some sort of conservation probably going on.
Yeah, but Jesus, I thought there was conservation of baryon number, so that law gets broken when an electron decays into a neutron and an antiproton with a neutrino. So that's a pretty fundamental law broken there.
Neutron, antiproton, and a neutrino. So don't the neutron and antiproton cancel each other off?
Oh, wait a minute. No, you're right. So it's just, if we had an electron of sufficient energy and impacted it with something, I guess we could get those particles, right?
Probably. Yes, I'm sure they do something like that. Maybe we should look into antiproton generation to see how they do it.
Yeah, but he's saying that it can decay into, which makes it sound like spontaneous decay, not a collision, you know?
Yeah, in this case, he's saying that an electron will be wandering around doing its own thing.
And then suddenly, boom, it's three different particles. Ah, yeah, I can't make any sense out of that.
It doesn't have to make that much sense. It's pretty theoretical. So we'd have to try to do a deep dive into time.
Well, that might be fun. We should do that sometime.
Yes, we should.
Was there anything else you wanted to bring up in that paper, Jim?
No, we talked about just about everything, I think. Again, they're pretty short papers this time, so the only difficulty somebody might have with them is that it does go into the theory of differential equations, partial differential equations. But other than that, I think everything is not too difficult. Really, I don't think you have to really understand what he's talking about other than you can categorize the different differential equations. I think he tells you how much of that is going on. He doesn't tell you why they're called hyperbolic and elliptic and stuff like that, but that doesn't really mean much.
Yeah, you just need to know that there are three different categories. You don't really need to know the theory behind them. There was an interesting statement in here that for the various covariant field equations of nature that describe our world, the matrix A will clearly have the same eigenvalues as the metric tensor.
Actually, yeah, that makes perfect sense. So it has to have that, right? So, I mean, if you just start thinking about what that matrix A means when you think about the Dirac equation or something like that, or the wave equation for light, it has exactly the signature of the metric tensor.
Oh, okay. I see what he's saying there.
Yeah, that's all he's saying. In different situations, in heat flow and stuff like that, they have some slightly different numbers based on physical characteristics if you've got a membrane or something like that. But for the fundamental things, when you look at any of those equations, it's just plus one, plus one, plus one, minus one, or vice versa.
Right, depending on which one you're using. Yeah. Is that a typo in that where he says the elliptic in the metric of signature and then he has five pluses? Shouldn't that be four pluses in there?
Where is this? It's right under that?
Yeah, right under that, right under the Klein-Gordon equation discussion, where he's showing the positive and negative signatures.
Yeah, that's a typo. That should be four.
I wanted to make sure I was missing something important. I was like, I can't be right.
Actually, it doesn't really matter, because all he's really doing is he's giving examples of each of the kind of signatures, right? So he just needs a signature that's all the same.
Yeah.
So it could be 5, it could be 20, it could be 2. It's still an elliptic equation. They're all pluses or all minuses.
All right. So thanks for going over the dimensionality of space-time with me tonight, Jim.
Well, thanks for talking, Randy. I hope everything goes well, and we can talk in a week or two or seven or whatever it is.
That sounds great. Let's do it soon. I want to keep the kitty full.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Be well, Jim.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers 38, The Dimensionality of Space-Time. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/38. This has links to the papers we discuss in the program, other episodes, those we discussed and those I think are related, and possibly some book recommendations. Since you've listened this far, I hope you've enjoyed our program. If you'd like to help out, please consider subscribing to us on Patreon or ordering books from Amazon through the show notes. Our Patreon page is located at www.patreon.com/physicsfrontiers. After we recorded this podcast, I did pick up one of these old Dover books on partial differential equations to try to brush up on what we were talking about. The one I picked up and the one I've been using is Stanley J. Farlow's Partial Differential Equations for Scientists and Engineers. I found this to be a very nice learning book if you have the background, if you've taken, say, a junior level electrodynamics course, or you've taken an ordinary differential equations course. This is a very good programmatic learning device that I think would help you with partial differential equations. I very much like his approach, the way he set everything up, and so forth and so on. It is a little bit old, but that means it's a Dover paperback and cheap. Thank you very much, and good night.